I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you're listening to the program and would like to contribute a story about the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, Hudson, New York, 12534, or prisonvoicesproject@gmail.com. This is the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective, and your host for today. Today's show is about Samuel Harrell, a 30-year-old man who died at the hands of prison guards at Fishkill Prison, located in Beacon, New York. In today's show, we will learn more about Samuel, his death, and the history and context of brutality in New York's prisons. Eric Jensen, one of Sam's close friends and an advocate for prison reform, describes the events leading up to Sam's death.
My name is Eric Jensen. I'm 34 years old and I live in Poughkeepsie, New York. I'm an advocate for criminal justice reform and against abuse and corruption inside correctional facilities. Samuel Harrell was diagnosed with bipolar disorder back in 2010. He changed. You know, he changed. He wasn't aggressive. He wasn't violent. But he would do weird things. Like, even his wife, Diane, said, you know, he would turn pictures around in his house because he felt they were staring at him. He would get real paranoid, delusional, thought the TV was talking, like, directly to him. So in 2015, April, he got a delusion. He was in Fishkill Prison. They weren't giving him his medication. And he was really depressed. His mother passed away that previous November. So he was sitting there, and a couple of the guys that were in there with him told the officers, listen, you know, this guy's something wrong with him. He's being real isolated. He's really depressed. His mother just passed away. They said they spoke to the officers a couple of days in a row because they noticed his, you know, isolation. So with that being said, Sam went to the officer one night and said, listen, my sister and my wife are outside. They're here to pick me up. And the officer said, you know, they're not here. And he said, listen, they're here. So he went and he actually packed a bag and he went and sat back down in the day room. Instead of calling, like, you know, medical assistance or anybody from the mental health department, he pulled the pin on his walkie-talkie. The pin on your walkie-talkie is when, you know, an alarm sounds, meaning that an officer needs help. So a bunch of officers come rushing down there. They ended up handcuffing Sam. They threw him to the floor. They stomped him. They beat him. They kicked him, punched him, everything you can imagine. And then they took him to the stairs and threw him down a flight of stairs with a sheet over him. And he was eventually put into a wheelchair and wheeled away. But the officers called for an ambulance. But they told the ambulance people, and when they made the call, they told the emergency personnel that he died from an overdose on synthetic marijuana. So with that being said, it's like they knew what they did and they caused his death, but they were trying to cover it up, in essence. You know, it was like intentionally trying to cover it up.
My name is Sharissa Harrell. I live in Kingston, New York. And Sammy Harrell was my baby brother. When I first got the news about my brother, the first phone call I got was from an inmate in there. And he called me, it was like 7:30 in the morning. And I always answer the call, you know, because I expected to be my brother. So it was another guy on the phone, and he was telling me that my brother got into something with the correctional officers of Fishkill Correctional Facility, and for me to call up there because they took him out and they haven't seen him. So I asked the guy, I was like, well, was he hurt? You know, did anything happen? And you could tell he was like frantic, like his voice, like he was like, just call up here. So I'm like, okay. So, you know, usually they don't answer their phones till 8:00. So I called his wife, and I told his wife that, you know, about the phone call, and that at 8:00 I was going to call to see what happened. But we didn't have to do that, because by 8:00, she ended up calling me like 5 or 10 minutes after 8, and she told me that the priest called her and told her Sam was dead. And my first thing when she called me, I just screamed. Like, I was like, no, I'm not hearing those words. I just screamed. And then I got off the phone with her, and I called the jail myself. And they told me the same thing, and I was just heartbroken. Like how could this happen? Like, I just seen him over the weekend. Like, I just seen him Saturday, and it's Wednesday, and he's not here. Like, I don't understand. I felt like my world was gone. Me and Sam are a year and 11 days apart. We've never been separated. Never been separated. The only time we were separated is when he went to jail. And we wasn't really separated then, because we always had phone calls. We always had visits. So, you know, he was still in my life. I still had him. And for me to get that phone call and know that I would never be able to speak to him again or see him again, it just tore my whole world apart. I was just... When they told me my brother was dead, I went off the back. I was like, I know you killed him. I told the superintendent, your guards killed my brother, because I know my brother. My brother is not confrontational. He doesn't disrespect authority. He respects people for what they are. And his main thing was coming home. So in order for you to come home, you have to obey. And he was always about that. Like, he never wanted any problems with any correctional officer, police officer. If he was caught doing something wrong, he took his punishment like a man and did his time. He wasn't a fighter. He wasn't that type of person. So when I got the call and I called and I asked him what happened and he couldn't give me nothing, I was just like, no, you killed him. He didn't. I know my brother not going to kill himself. He's not suicidal. And he doesn't have problems with other people in there. So the only thing I can get from this is your guards had to have done this. And I was right. And so I started immediately. Immediately I called IG Albany. Immediately I called my lawyer. Immediately I let the superintendent know that my lawyers and them was going to be in contact with them. And it started as soon as I got that phone call about my brother. I didn't waste no time. It was ruled a homicide from the altercation of the correctional officers.
And have any of the corrections officers been charged with murder?
No, no one has been charged. They're still working.
How has that felt for you, just to know that there's no accountability?
Heartbroken, because I if it was the other way around and my brother had harmed one of them, I know for a fact he would have been handcuffed and read his rights, and he would have been in jail. He would have been under the jail. So for somebody of that authority that's supposed to protect and serve, help rehabilitate inmates, and for them to do what they've done and nothing has been done, it hurts me. It really gives me a sense of no hope in the system. Like, who do they really stand for? Who do they represent? When wrong is wrong, it's supposed to be charged and dealt with, and nothing has happened. So right now, my days are filled with prayers that something is going to be done about it.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. That was Sarissa Harrell, the sister of Samuel Harrell, who was killed by corrections officers in Fishkill Prison in April 2015. Sarissa has been working with Beacon Prison Action, a group that was formed in part in response to her brother's death, to hold the Department of Corrections responsible for the violence and brutality that is happening at places like Fishkill. Eric Jensen, Samuel Harrell's friend, has been working closely with the family to document the events surrounding Samuel's death. Here, he talks about the civil case that has been filed against the state in the death of Samuel Harrell.
In the family's civil complaint is we have 19 sworn affidavits from witnesses that actually seen what happened to Samuel Harrell in Fishkill. The thing is that the spokesperson for the Department of Corrections said we can't take a violent felony offender's word over a correctional officer. But to say that, people are lying, of course I know that people do lie, they embellish. But if they were lying, I believe that all their stories would be exactly the same. But they're not. They're a little bit different perspectives. Everybody then get together in cahoots and say, listen, we're going to say this happened because that's what, we want them. We want to get these officers in trouble. That's not what happened. They have different witness accounts from different perspectives, different locations, but it's all the same thing.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. Next up, We Shall Be Released by Nina Simone.
They say everything can be replaced. Say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. Oh, I see my light come shine. Fall.
a man in this lonely crowd. Man who says he's not to blame. All day long I hear him hollering so loud, just crying out that he's not to blame.
Prison Action held an event this February to discuss the conditions of confinement for people like Samuel. Leading experts discussed issues such as mental health provision behind bars, oversight and accountability, and the grievance process in prison. Paul Merzfelder of Beacon Prison Action facilitated the event and introduced Johnny Perez, one of the first speakers, who spoke about mental health provision behind bars.
Johnny Perez is a non-attorney advocate at the Urban Justice Center Mental Health Project. Specifically, he is assigned to the Safe Reentry Project, where he works with people with mental illness and histories of incarceration to connect them with services in the community that will assist them to attain better measures of recovery and gain stability necessary to avoid further contact with the criminal justice system. Johnny also works to change unjust policies and practices in the criminal justice system through his participation in the Jails Action Coalition, the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement, or CAKE, and New York Reentry Education Network. Johnny is also a member of the New York City Bar Association's Correction and Reentry Committee. Drawing on the wisdom of 13 years of direct involvement with the criminal justice system, Johnny has held speaking engagements at Cornell Law, Fordham University, Amnesty International, the United Nations, and the American Justice Summit. Please join me in welcoming Johnny Perez.
So I want to say, imagine having a bad day, right? You have a bad day, worst day ever. Today's been the worst day. You go home, you know, you might take your clothes off, take a bubble bath, pour a glass of wine, I don't know, watch Orange is the New Black. And I said, tomorrow is a whole nother day, right? Now imagine having a bad day every day, every single day, where every day is just like the day before, and the day before that, and the day before that, and the day before that, and the day before that. Then imagine living in a world where you have to constantly test people's, evaluate people's intentions, where the same people that are supposed to protect you are actually more likely to victimize you, right? And you can't just seem to make sense of it. Then imagine, on top of all of that, you also have a mental illness. And for a lot of people who are living with mental illness and who are also incarcerated, this is the reality for them. So when we think about mental illness as it relates to people who are incarcerated, you know, first we have to also understand the culture, which, you know, I hope Wesley can talk about that. The culture within the prison environment that is a highly stigmatized environment where if you identify as even having a mental illness, you actually are more at risk of being victimized. So what happens is a lot of folks will not identify as having a mental illness. And as a result of that, the bad part about that is that they can go days, weeks, months, sometimes even years without receiving any kind of treatment, whether it's therapy, medication, you know, things of that nature. And then when we receive them on the outside, and we deal with folks who have been untreated for years, not because, not necessarily by choice, but because they felt that was the only choice that they had. So what ends up happening is that, sorry about that. And okay, so for some people, for the people that actually do receive treatment, they find themselves receiving lackluster treatment. We interviewed one guy. He said that he was actually handcuffed during a therapy session. Right? Think about that. Right? You were handcuffed during a therapy session. Right? And then speaking again about the culture, sometimes you even have officers who say, "Well, maybe you need some bullpen therapy." And what that looks like is a person just being locked inside the bullpen all day, or in a large cell all day. And, you know, you just sit there as a form of punishment. And I'm going to get into solitary in a minute. We find that people who are living with mental illness are highly dehumanized in that environment. On top of the other dehumanization that they already face just being a prisoner inside of jail. And that reflects itself in some of the language, right? You might hear a correctional officer say, "Hey, how many heads do you have today? You know, how many bodies do you have over there? Bring me 10 bodies, right?" Or they might say, "Hey, you, come here." Or, I don't know, 5068, and just say your dead number, you know, come here. And what that does to a person is that not only we find a lot of people who re-enter society actually internalize some of this dehumanization and the oppression and internalize it and have this learned helplessness, but also they are actually at more risk of getting into misbehavior while they're in prison. As a result of that, they might find themselves or a higher likelihood of finding themselves in solitary. When it comes to solitary, if you don't know anything about solitary outside of what just Scott said, you know, imagine being in a space the same size as your arms outstretched for the tallest person. I'm 6 feet tall, and I've been in solitary cells where I can touch both walls with both my hands. And that's really about it. You have the sink here, the toilet here. You might have a window, you might not. You might have a mirror, you might not. More than likely, you probably don't have a mirror. People go years without seeing what they look like. Something that we on the outside take for granted. And psychologists tell you play so much into our self-concept, self-esteem, and so on and so forth. For people who are living with mental illness, a lot of these problems are tenfold because sometimes they don't even understand what's going on. So, of course, by law, if they're seriously mentally ill, they're not supposed to be placed in solitary. But what happens is we find that DOC sometimes reclassifies people and say, "Hey, we thought you were severely mentally ill, but now we think that you're just mildly ill and we can actually put you in solitary." The doctor might come to the cell door, ask you, "Hey, do you feel like killing yourself? Do you need any help?" You know. And in some cells, which are double bunk, you know, a person is not compelled to really talk to a psychiatrist through a glass door or get on their knees to talk through a little slide and tell them what their issue is. And in the event that they are taken out, they have to go through the process of being handcuffed, shackled, escorted. Things that people say, "You know what? I don't like wearing handcuffs. I'd rather just not deal with it." We find that solitary is used as a retaliatory tool. You know, there's been instances where you might have a correctional officer who just straight threatens you to put you in a box. You know, and, you know, contrary to popular belief or what some other folks might say, people really don't want to be there and are actually afraid of going there. And the reality of it is that if an officer says that I hit him, it's really that simple for me to be disciplined physically or in other ways, or to just be, you know, and therefore be placed in a box. There's been instances where people have been placed in a box for absolutely no reason. And in the event that they are placed in a box, you find that people are placed for extended long periods of time for minor offenses. You know, there's times when people receive a year in solitary for testing positive for marijuana. And then while they're there, they're not receiving any kind of mental health, adequate mental health treatment, any type of educational programs, anger management, or let alone drug treatment. You would think if somebody went to the box for testing positive, that drug treatment would be on the top of their list, and it's not. The problem with this is that people are more likely to commit these same kind of misbehaviors once they're released. And another note about that, which sometimes people don't realize or don't know, is that any misbehavior report that you receive while you're in solitary only leads to more solitary time. Even if that misbehavior report did not initially lead you there, or would have not even led you there in the box had you been in general population. So what does that look like, right? That means that a person who is sentenced to 60 days for having contraband, right, can actually end up in there for years at a time for receiving an accumulated amount of tickets while they're there. And therefore, all of the other problems that I said are actually tenfold. In addition to that, we find that some people are released directly from solitary into society, right? Think about that, because you go from a place of sensory deprivation, right? Sometimes it gets so quiet that you can hear your heartbeat, or so loud that you have to go to sleep to the sound of other men crying, laughing, rapping, joking, or any other sound or, you know, cacophony that the human voice box can make. The light stays on all day. You know, the officer, your last meal is at 4 o'clock, sometimes 5, but the next meal is at 7 o'clock, so you're going over 12 hours without actually eating. And sometimes that food might actually be cold. And going from that kind of environment, right, where you have little to no human interaction, you know, sometimes officers don't even want to have eye contact with you. You know, today you might walk by me, you don't look at me, I don't look at you, it's nothing. But when the person that feeds you day in and day out won't even look at you, it does something to you, right? And then you're released into Tyler Society, and I'm from New York City, so most people are released directly into 42nd Street, Times Square. How many of you have been in Times Square before, Jan? Right? So you're released into Times Square, right, with a bag, $40, right? A bus ride, bus ticket, well, you already got that, right? And you're like, okay, what do I do now? The Statue of Liberty is having a fight with Elmo in the corner. Everybody's bumping into you. Nobody's saying excuse me. You haven't even acclimated yourself yet, right? And you have to report to parole within 24 hours. But except that you've been in prison for the last 20 years, and you don't even know where that is at. Some of the common problems that we find in our office based on research we just actually completed, we find that people are released with no medication at all. People are overdiagnosed, underdiagnosed. Over-medicated, under-medicated. People are receiving bad information. A gentleman received an address to a building that no longer existed. He kept walking by the building thinking that his mental health was playing tricks on him, so to speak. Now, knowing that the building never existed, but he wanted to know because he's been gone for years at a time. So these are some things I just want to kind of put out there and let you ponder as I pass it along to the next panelist. Thanks for letting me share.
Scott Paltritz is an associate director of the Prison Visiting Project of the Correctional Association of New York and a member of the New York Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. Again, CAKE. You might be noticing a pattern here.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Alexandra Cox, one of the hosts of the project. I had an opportunity to attend an event on abuse in New York State prisons that was convened by Beacon Prison Action in February 2016. Here we will be hearing excerpts from that event.
Through investigative research, report writing, coalition building, organizing, and advocacy, Scott works with the Correctional Association towards a more humane and effective system of addressing needs and behaviors currently labeled criminal, as well as more racially and economically just and equitable society. He's been involved in investigating, documenting, and advocating about abuses that have taken place at Fishkill, among other prisons in New York. Scott's work with CAKE is aimed at ending the torture of solitary confinement in New York prisons and jails, including through the passage of the Halt Solitary Confinement Act. Scott is also a member of Beyond Attica and the National Lawyers Guild Mass Incarceration Committee. So, Scott Paltritz, I'd like to start with you. As the Associate Director of the Visiting Prison Project, you've contributed to investigating and reporting on the conditions at Fishkill. Can you tell us more about the Visiting Prison Project and also some of its notable findings concerning Fishkill Correctional?
Sure. Thanks, everybody. And thanks, Paul. Let me just start, even before I do that, to just say that I am truly humbled to be here today, particularly Ms. Harrell, that you're here with us today. I'm kind of overwhelmed with emotion at the moment, just hearing more about Samuel and Benjamin. So I just wanted to acknowledge that, and that's how I was feeling. But also I'm honored to be on a panel with these amazing individuals. It's really a powerhouse. You're all in store for a treat, so I'm really grateful to be here with you all. And Beacon Prison Action, you know, after hearing about Mr. Harrell's death, has done amazing work to try to bring attention to the horrific abuses that have taken place at Fishkill and around the state. So there's a lot of good things happening, and mostly, look at all of you in this room. I'm excited about what we can do to try to bring justice and peace and humanity to this community and across the state. Sorry for the long intro, but I just felt like I needed to say something like that. At the Prison Visiting Project, we have a legislative right to go inside of New York State's prisons, even though we're a nonprofit independent agency. And we use that right to expose what's happening inside, to shine a light on what's happening, and then mostly to push for change, to challenge the overall incarceration system, as well as to work on particular issues like brutality inside and solitary confinement. At Fishkill, the Correctional Association has issued a number of different reports related to the facility, which are particularly devastating in light of what has happened to Samuel at that very prison. In 2005 and then in 2013, the CA issued reports that documented so many of the issues that ended up leading to, you know, Mr. Harrell's death. And I'm going to highlight just five key points to try not to take too much time. The first is just an ongoing culture of violence and abuse by staff at the prison. And particularly in the 3 to 11 p.m. shift and in buildings 21 and 21A. And that's exactly where Mr. Harrell was killed last April. So we had documented these abuses, raised concern about the racist nature of many of the officers in that unit, in those units, and the staff harassment as well as physical brutality that takes place in those units and on that shift. The second, also related, is about the treatment of people who have mental health issues. As was mentioned earlier, Samuel was diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. Unfortunately, at Fishkill, from the line staff all the way up to the administration, we were really exacerbated by the attitudes that were displayed in terms of people's approach, staff's approach to people who had mental health issues at the prison. And even at the highest levels of the administration at the time that we were last there, you know, referring to people who had engaged in acts of self-harm as malingerers, as fakers, as everybody who would engage in some kind of self-harm or suicide attempt was just trying to get out of a disciplinary ticket or was just trying to get some privilege, as opposed to recognizing that people in their prison actually had serious mental health issues and mental health needs that needed responses and approaches that matched those needs. And at Fishkill, there's a large number of people who have mental health issues. It is an Office of Mental Health facility, and it's a growing number of people who have mental health needs at that prison. So even in the last few years, from 2012, there were 460 people at the prison who are on the OMH caseload. Now it's over 620 people. So there's only more people being sent to that prison who have mental health issues. And again, this attitude that went from the line staff all the way up to the highest levels of the administration was to failure to recognize that individuals had actual mental health needs. The third point I wanted to raise, which is related to the first two, is the widespread use of solitary confinement at Fishkill. Fishkill has what they call is an S block or a SHU 200, which is 100 cells with 200 people in them in isolated confinement 23 to 24 hours a day without any meaningful human contact or programs. There are 8 of these S-blocks around the state, so at this place, if people get sent from other prisons to Fishkill just to be held in solitary confinement. Fishkill also has its own individual SHU. It's another 48-cell SHU that people can be held in, again, 23 to 24 hours a day. For months and years at a time at Fishkill, people are held in these conditions. We're going to hear more about solitary, I think, later from some of the other folks. The fourth point I wanted to just mention is that in addition to the large number of people who have mental health needs at Fishkill, there also are a large number of other particularly vulnerable individuals at the prison. And I'm going to just mention one group, which is elderly people and people who have cognitive impairments. So at Fishkill, 30% of the people who are incarcerated there are 50 and older. And for people who are incarcerated, studies show that actually your age is about 10 to 15 years older biologically than your actual age. So somebody who's 50, I use that number because that's actually the equivalent of people on the outside who would be age 60 or 65 in terms of their medical needs. And yet almost a third of the people at Fishkill are 50 years or older. And they have two particular units that I wanted to mention. One is a long-term care unit, which is essentially for people who have extremely severe medical issues and often terminal illnesses, people who are suffering from cancer, from heart disease, end-of-life care, hospice care at the facility. And the other issue, or the other unit I wanted to mention, is a unit for the cognitively impaired, is what it's called. And it's people who have mental cognitive limitations. And a lot of that is for people who have conditions like Alzheimer's or dementia, although it can include other conditions. And when I was in the prison visiting throughout the project that we have and doing, we call it visiting, but really we're doing investigations of what's happening inside, and you walk on either of those two units, the long-term care unit or the cognitive disabilities unit, and you really just have to stop and say, you know, why? Why are these individuals even in prison in the first place? I mean, I have a sense, why are any of the people in the prison in prison in the first place? But when you're there, you really see the absurdity and the extreme punishment that we are using in this state and in this country to have people who are suffering from dementia be held in these prison walls. And the fifth point I wanted to mention before my time runs out is that all of the challenges that are happening at Fishkill, unfortunately, are not just limited to Fishkill, but they are pervasive across the entire DOCS prison system of 54 prisons and 54,000 people who are incarcerated on any given day. The kind of pervasive and entrenched culture of brutality that is premised on a racist notion and a punitive notion of how we should treat people is pervasive across the facilities. And last year, unfortunately, within a week of when Samuel was killed, another man named Carl Taylor at Sullivan, which is also not too far from here, was also killed after being beaten up by corrections officers. And if you've paid attention this year, if you want to look back this year to articles in the New York Times or the Albany Times Union, there's been some exposure of other brutality. Not that this brutality is new, but there's more exposure of it at places like Clinton and Attica and Great Meadow and Southport. But basically, if you name any prison in this state, you'll have cases of extreme physical brutality, let alone all the other dehumanization, racism, and abuse that takes place. So I think I'm going to stop there. I look forward to talking more about how we can not only just expose these issues, talk about them, but take action to try to challenge and change and end the abuses that are taking place. Thank you.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project. Today, we're listening to excerpts from an event convened in response to the death of Samuel Harrell, a 30-year-old man incarcerated at Fishkill Prison.
Next, we have Wesley Canes, or Wes Canes. Wes is proud to be a reentry specialist, coordinator, and advocate for Brooklyn Defender Services. A graduate of Bard College and the New York Theological Seminary, Wesley is well-suited to the dual task of educating around criminal justice issues and helping others understand their personal responsibility for their own positive life outcomes. At Brooklyn Defender Services, Wesley is tasked with creating a reentry program based on the organization's core principle of comprehensive human service. A member of the Board of Directions of the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, he also lends his expertise to helping those who are economically disadvantaged improve their criminal justice outcomes by making bail. An outspoken advocate, he recently wrote an op-ed published in the Times Union titled, "Strengthen Prison Oversight to Quell Prison Brutalizing Inmates." Addressing the long history of prisoner, the op-ed addressed the long-standing history of prisoner abuse at Fishkill and facilities statewide. Please join me in welcoming Wes Canes.
And I want to speak about the grievance process, because part of what we would hope would happen in a correctional setting is that individuals will learn to utilize the system in a productive, nonviolent way. So you and I have a problem, we go to the local precinct, we file a complaint, an investigation is done. If need be, some action is taken. We feel as if there was some relief gained from our sense of injustice that we perceived that happened. Inside, that process plays out with a grievance program. And this grievance program is intended, it's derived after the Attica riot, which is very illustrative of the understanding, the decades-long understanding of how repressive the prison space can be. So after the Attica riots, what happened was that there were certain mechanisms put in place that would afford individuals who are incarcerated a chance to voice their concerns and their grievances about things. So the grievance process exists. What happens if you have an issue, you do a write-up and you submit it to the administration and it's heard by a panel. This panel consists of two or three staff members and two or three prisoners who were elected by their peers as representative for this body. They hear the grievance and they vote majority rule on a determination as to how this is supposed to play out. The exception to this process that I just described is if the grievance that's filed is an allegation of abuse or harassment by a particular staff member against a particular prisoner. Then those grievances are categorized differently and are sent directly to the facility superintendent, who is tasked with doing an investigation or designating a more senior staff member to do an investigation and finding a determination. This is important in Fishkill particularly, but really throughout the state. This is important because this is the moment when administrators have an opportunity to set the cultural tone in a facility. And if you have hundreds, no exaggeration, if you have hundreds of complaints against specific officers over a series of months, very detailed, very similar complaints that comes across your desk, and you rubber stamp these grievances as being unfounded because your investigation entailed asking that staff member, is this true? And if they say no, that's the end of it. You set the tone for a culture that develops in the facility and becomes ingrained. So in Fishkill, you have this. The outcome of that in Fishkill is that you have officers who do not engage in this type of behavior, who would utilize the officers who do abuse as the boogeymen. So if they perceive a prisoner as being particularly difficult, the threat becomes, I will send you to 21 or 21A building if you keep talking to me like that. It's as simple as that. And you know, once you go up that hill to 21 or 21A, what's going to come.
Isaac Scott is a self-taught graphic designer and fine artist. His passion for social justice and criminal justice reform runs deep, as he is directly affected by the criminal justice system and its disenfranchising nature. In November 2013, Isaac was released on good behavior from New York State Prison after serving 7 years, 8 months, and 16 days of his 9-year sentence. For 3 years during his incarceration, Scott worked as an inmate grievance representative at several facilities, including Fishkill Correctional. Today, Isaac is a leader in advocacy with goals to induce criminal justice reform through the transformative and storytelling power of the arts. Selected just last summer as the Justice and Education Scholar, Scott has found a place at Columbia University's Center for Justice, where he can use his creativity in many ways to induce change.
A lot of times, grievances don't get filed in the first place because of retaliation. Flat out. Depending on where you're at, if you're in the box and you file a complaint, you possibly have to, you have to deal with the same officer on your gallery every day. He may not feed you. He may spit in your food. He may not open your rec pen door so you can get that 1 hour of recreation that day, because that's how your recreation is. They go down the line and hit your button one time. If you're not at the door and they hit that button, they don't go back through. You don't get your recreation,
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm one of the members of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Next up, Eric Jensen, a good friend of Samuel Harrell's, who's been advocating for accountability in the state prison system following Samuel's death, describes the people who were responsible for Samuel's death and how he was affected by the brutality behind bars when he himself was incarcerated.
So a bunch of officers come rushing down there, and in Fishkill, they're known as the beat-up squad. Clinton, Attica, they're known as the Black Glove crew. Every facility has this certain faction of officers that are, pretty much lawless. They don't have to follow the rules, and they get away with it. They've been getting away with it for, almost a century, probably. my main motivation is that, you know, all right, let me go back to 2011, August 19th, 2011. I got my teeth kicked in. I have two fake front teeth in my mouth because of an officer in Clinton Correctional Facility. There was a mini fight between about 15 people on the flats in the yard, and shots were fired. Everybody had to get down on the ground, and we were nowhere near it. We were on our court. But what they did was they zip-tied everybody. I'm talking like close to 600 people.
Could you explain what zip-tied means?
Yeah, it's like plastic flex cuffs. They're handcuffs, but they're like, you know, the big zip ties. So they zip-tie your hands and your feet. So we were all hog-tied. And they came through and just beat people up. But they actually kicked my teeth. And I take them out. My DIN number is still on them. I feel that people shouldn't be able to get away with stuff like that. You know, for them to deny any wrongdoing in not only Sam's case, but, you know, there's George Williams. There's a whole bunch of other cases like this that they won't even, like send a card to their family or to say, listen, you know, we're sorry. It doesn't go down like that. And, you know, we're human beings, you know. Compassion and empathy are supposed to be like, you know, love, everything is supposed to be like the foundation for humanity, but it's not. It's messed up when you can just take somebody's life at work, and then you can go home and post pictures on your Facebook that same evening, you know, going to your son's baseball game or you know, going out with your wife for dinner, and that's what it is. You know, and those list of officers, I went back, looked up their Facebook. You can go back to that date and you can see what they did after work or the next day, and it's like, how heartless can you be?
You know, you've spent time in a prison sort of far upstate like Dannemora, and you've spent time in the Ulster County Jail and down here. What to you sort of distinguishes that experience? You know, like, is there anything kind of different about the culture of the prisons upstate than there are about the culture of the prisons down here?
Yeah, definitely. Like Attica and Clinton, two of the worst in the state. It's desolate. It's these prisons were built, and then the communities formed around the prison. You know, it wasn't the other way. The community wasn't there before Clinton was there. You know, so by that is, it's everybody, that's their main focus, you know, and everybody in the town knows that it's a form of like, they don't care what goes on inside those walls. So and it's very, very rare that things make it outside of those walls as well. You know, there's a huge code of silence, and you know, that's one thing I'm glad that prison break did happen, because it shined a light and it put everything under a microscope, and now things are actually being listened to. You know, people are actually being able to voice what happened in there, and people listen. The culture in prison, you don't talk about it, because if you talk about it, you get viewed as a snitch. Even though you're telling on somebody that beat somebody up or that killed somebody, you're still viewed as a snitch. And it's, the mentality is, you know, it's insanity. For you to be able to watch something happen to somebody, and you may not be involved, but by you not saying something or intervening, you might as well be the one over there doing it to him. And that's what I mean by code of silence. You know, don't get me wrong, there are some great officers, there are some really good guys that looked out, but you know, I'm not, and if I'm talking to them, you know, they have nothing to worry about, because they do their job. You know what I mean? They don't go out of their way to, you know, harm or injure somebody. They go by the book. You know, and that's all it's about, going by the book. I think if they seen something, and there's a couple officers have said something about things they've seen, and what they do is they get harassed at work. They get inmate lover written on their lockers, or they get things spray painted on their car. Yeah, so it's when they do, and then when they go to, you know, report that, nobody cares. So now it's like, why should I even say anything now? Now I'm just here to make my money and go home.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Those of you who are listening inside, write us with your comments, suggestions, and ideas.
Next up, Don't Want to Fight by the Alabama Shakes. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. This show has been about the culture of brutality in New York State prisons that led to the death of 30-year-old Samuel Harrell from Kingston, New York. I want to end this show with words from his good friend Eric Jensen and his sister Sarissa, talking about what he was like and who he was as we pay tribute to him in his death.
Sam was, he's a big guy. He was about 230 pounds, 6'3", muscular, fit. And you look at him, and it is not the, let me see, like if you were to judge a book by a cover, you'd be totally wrong, because Sam had the kindest heart. He would give you the shirt off his back. And, you know, a lot of people that didn't know him might be intimidated by him, but he was funny. He always had a smile on his face. I never once heard him raise his voice, and I never seen him raise his hand to anybody.
And I'm going to continue doing what I have to do until that, till I get justice till he gets justice. Mm-hmm. He has no voice right now. So us, we're going to be his voice.
How do you think he feels about what's happening right now? If he could speak to you and see what you're doing.
He will be happy because he always told me, he was like, you know, if anything happened to me, he's like, you better go hard. And I was like, no, I would. Like, he's like my twin. We've never been apart. Both our birthdays are in December. So we always celebrated together. We didn't do too much that wasn't, you know. So right now, he would be happy. He would be proud of me because I'm not, he knows I'm not going to stop. He knows I'm going to go over and beyond to make sure everybody hears it, everybody knows what's happened. And before the end of it, he's going to know that I did the best I could to make sure you got your justice. He will be happy.
He'll be upset.
He'll be sad because he's not here, but he'll be happy that, you know, we're doing what we're supposed to do. We're not just letting that just go.
Yeah.
To the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you're listening to the program and would like to contribute a story about the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, Hudson, New York, 12534, or Prison Voices Project at gmail.com.